It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to Tricia Zunker, the Democratic candidate running in next Tuesday's special election to fill the empty 7th congressional seat here in Wisconsin. First, the Community Cookbook has been around for a long time, with neighbors or families, members of a religious community or co-workers getting together to share the practical recipes they use. We'd like to hear from you on this week's edition of Food Friday. Have you participated in making a community cookbook? Do you have any that you use in your own kitchen from the recent or distant past? What do you value about these community cookbooks? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our next guest saw these days of physical isolation as an opportunity to bring back the concept in an online setting. Crystal Mack is a Baltimore-based chef and interdisciplinary artist. She's edited a digital community cookbook called How to Take Care. It includes a wide variety of food and drink recipes and entries on breathing, body scanning, foraging, soap making, and more, submitted by Mack's friends and colleagues. The book's production was also intended to help support domestic violence victims. Crystal, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Before we talk about your and your colleagues' new community cookbook, can you talk about some of the ones that you have around that were part of your inspiration?
Definitely. So a lot of the community cookbooks that I have, I've actually gotten from family members, or they were just handed down over the years. People who knew that I loved to cook as a home cook turned chef eventually, they would gift them to me for birthdays and holidays. So I just kind of built up a little collection over the years, and I even go to youth bookstores sometimes and purchase them. And the thing I really love about community cookbooks is that it's such a wide range of recipes, and oftentimes they double up on recipes and you can see the variations in them and just see essentially the story that a recipe tells, you know, what ingredients were available at the time, or, you know, what makes this one person's pound cake way more special than someone else's, or unique than to someone else's. So I just really love the sense of community, I guess, that community cookbooks provide. And usually when they are created, they're created to raise funds for a specific cause. So a number of the cookbooks that I have are church cookbooks from my family church or from churches around the country. And, you know, oftentimes those cookbooks were to raise money for a new roof for the church or expanding the church building and making it a little bit larger. So I just love the idea of people coming together for a good cause and connecting with food, something that sustains us and nourishes us.
Something I love about these kind of cookbooks is this is practical stuff. This is stuff that people like me can make and know how to make and are sharing here. Can you talk about that side of things? Like you said, it's stuff that's going to be available in the community. You don't have to mail order the ingredients for this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I wanted to make sure that the people who were contributing, you know, when I put the call out, I essentially posted on social media and also reached out to some friends, but, you know, asking them if you want to contribute. You don't have to be a chef. You don't have to be a whiz in the kitchen. What is something that brings you joy right now? And what is something that is affordable? Some of the submissions that were submitted by my chef friends, you know, they definitely initially were a little out there. And I'm like, all right, guys, kind of rein it back in. Not everyone has a waffle cone maker at home.
I wish I did.
I know, I wish. But, you know, the recipe that I really love, Whatever's Left, an infused cooking oil with spices and scraps by Morgan Stewart. I really, really love that. Morgan is a chef out of Buffalo, New York. And her recipe for infused cooking oil is essentially made with whatever you have. So if you have orange peels, don't toss them or compost them. Use them to infuse your oil with orange oil and give it a little bit more of a vibrant essence. Peanuts, herbs, things like that, you know, things that you might already have. If you have herbs in your, you know, spice cabinet, put those to use. So I really, really love that, you know, these are things that aren't too daunting to make. The potato bhaji in the cookbook for two, that was submitted by Eatlyn D'Souza, and she is actually in quarantine. Well, not in quarantine. She's sheltering in place in India. and she submitted her potato bhaji, which is a recipe that they typically eat for breakfast, but it's very affordable, and it's something that she watched her sister cook for them growing up. So she figured if it was something that a child could make, it could be easy and accessible for an adult to make while we are all sheltering in place wherever we are. So I just really love that these are recipes that are affordable, thoughtful, and they have meaning to the contributors.
We're talking to Crystal Mack, a Baltimore-based chef. She's the editor of this new digital community cookbook we're talking about. It's called How to Take Care. And we've got a couple of recipes, including the ones she just mentioned, over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We're talking about community cookbooks, past and present. She and her friends and colleagues made one. You may have some that you've contributed to or that you cherish around your own home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I like to, if I go on a trip, I like to see if I can pick up a community cookbook from someplace or from a church. I find that people contribute their best recipes, maybe to impress their friends.
Absolutely.
Kate,
that was
thank
my
you so much.
Grandmother, for sure.
Yeah, that's a kindred spirit for you, Crystal. She goes around collecting these, too. Do you, you know, when you are traveling, when we can travel, do you do what Kay does and say, hold on, everybody, I got to get into this used bookstore for a minute?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love bookstores, period. Used bookstores definitely have some good finds. They're affordable, sustainable, repurposing. And it's nice to have someone's energy on a book already that you've had. I think it's a really cool thing. And she's totally right about people one-upping each other on their recipes.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to get a little more, Crystal, into the inspiration for the How to Take Care book. And you mentioned with community cookbooks of the past, there is this community spirit about them, people pulling together for a cause. So can you talk a little more about what you were hoping to get out of this when you reached out to your friends and colleagues in the industry?
Sure. I was just actually hoping to draw awareness to the issue of domestic violence and intimate partner violence that would possibly uptick as we all begin to shelter in place. And I wanted to find a way to support those victims and support those survivors and kind of lighten the load for the organizations that might be getting onslaught at this time. So in my mind, I was thinking, you know, this would be great to not only bring attention to this issue, but also get some funds their way. And I wasn't expecting a large amount of funds. I was like, oh, this will be a nice little humble $1,000 that we could raise. But so far to date, we've raised $6,069. Wow. Yeah, so that's very and all of that money is directly given to those organizations. We have right. no connection to that. I wanted to make sure that people understood that no money was coming to me or my design studio was going directly to the organization of their choosing. And then when they forward their receipt, we will send them the link to the cookbook. And it's amazing that amount of money. You know, some people were like, I was waiting till I got my stimulus check and I don't necessarily need all of it. So I'm going to give portions of it to your cause and portions of it to causes in my community. People from all around the world, Singapore, London, Maui, all over have contributed and gotten a copy of How to Take Care. So it's really special to see how food can bring us together in times of isolation. We just have to be a little bit more improvisational, I guess, when it comes to our approach.
So this could be something to get this, as you say, it's free if people have donated to something that supports victims of domestic violence. And that could be they could be donating to something in their own community or their own state. You're not specifying which particular group.
Yeah, I mean, we had a few you were pointing folks to, but I would love people to, you know, give back to their communities. You know, I am only really familiar with House of Ruth in Maryland and Turnaround Inc. in Baltimore. So I, you know, it's hard to keep up with all of the organizations doing much needed work. So I encourage everyone to, you know, share the cause with their friends, but also give back to their own organizations in their community. You know, if you want to help, it always helps to start at home first.
We're talking to chef and artist Crystal Mack about her new digital community cookbook. It's called How to Take Care. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been involved in creating a community cookbook, maybe in your neighborhood or your family or your religious community, your workplace? Tell us about that. Do you love to collect these? Do you have a favorite, cherished one that you like to cook a particular recipe from? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Baltimore-based chef Crystal Mack. We're talking about the new community cookbook she's edited. It's called How to Take Care. It includes recipes and practices for comforting and healing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked on some kind of a community cookbook online or in print? Do you have a favorite one? Are there ways you're reaching out to find community that relate to food right now when it's hard to get people together in person? Call 800-642-1234. By the way, we've got a few recipes from the book Crystal edited. You can find them at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can find out more about the book. Go to WPR.org Central Time. We've got a link that'll tell you how to get it if you make that donation, as we're hearing, that's going to help victims of domestic violence. Let's go back to your calls now. Shelley is on the line in Madison. Shelley, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for this program. So I have contributed to cookbooks, and the ones I've contributed to have primarily been through different locations I've been stationed with the military. The groups that I was with, oftentimes the people would get together, men and women, and create one of the cookbooks. But just recently, I pulled up the cookbook that my mother had contributed to for St. Jerome's Catholic Church in Columbus, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I pulled up a banana bread recipe. And, oh, my gosh, it has been so good. I have made probably that banana bread four times in the last 2 months.
Well, Shelley, I want to ask you before I let you go, having been in the military and I imagine moving from place to place and meeting different people, was building these cookbooks with people around you a great icebreaker, a way to make connections as you move from place to place?
Absolutely. First of all, you're right. It was a great way to meet and interact with people in that you maybe were kind of thrown together. I will tell you the other thing that's been nice about it. I will pull that cookbook out now, and I'll look through, and I'll see somebody's name, and then I will typically go out and try to find that person because I may not have talked to them in 10 years or 20 years, and that's really fun. Or you see... you see their name in their recipe, and you get great memories back. The other nice thing about that is because I got to live in a lot of different places is that there are so many different kinds of flavors and cultures in those.
Shelley, so really thank you so much. I want to bring Crystal back into this. So Shelley gave us a lot to work with, Crystal. Where do you want to run with that?
I think that's so special, and I'm glad that she touched on, you know, the melting pot that American food can be, you know, essentially just that shared cultural experience of what it means to be American, and regionally even the different takes on things that we hold dear, the different takes on hamburgers, hot dogs, cakes, pies, barbecue, even, as we all know, is so different in different parts of the country. So it's such a special thing. And I love that she looks people up from back in the day. I think that's really cool. And I think that's a great way to stay in community.
Shelley, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Before we go back to our callers, Crystal, she mentioned banana bread. And I understand the people who track these things. This is the most searched recipe during, you know, stay-at-home orders.
Yes.
And I think you have some thoughts on banana bread.
Yeah, we have a banana bread recipe, actually, and we have a banana bread recipe that's a little bit different and has chocolate chips and sorghum flour, which is a grain that's really popular in the South. It's actually a West African grain that came over during the slave trade, but it began to be really popular in the South, and you find it a lot with, like, sorghum popcorn, essentially, there. But it's a really earthy, delicious, wheat flour, and I love the way that it's used by Atara Bernstein, who was one of the contributors in her recipe, and that's one of her recipes that she's, I asked her, did you make this yourself? This is really amazing. And she was like, yeah, you know, everyone has their own banana bread recipe. And I was like, this is true. My banana bread recipe, which I wasn't sure if I was going to include it. And I compared my recipe to Atara's and I was like, we should go with Atara's. My banana bread recipe actually uses the peels of bananas. And it's a very long process. And it's one that you don't want to, when you're really hard up and you don't want to waste anything. It tastes exactly like banana bread and you wouldn't know it uses the peels, but it takes a long time to soak the bananas, change the water. It takes about like a week to do so. And you have to make sure you have organic bananas. So that might be an accessibility issue. So I was saying, let's stick to basic banana bread, but not so basic with the addition of chocolate chips and sorghum, which is so delicious.
Nice. Thanks again for the call, Shelley. We'll go to Ann now in Wautoma. Ann, hi.
Hi. You know, I've been a cookbook collector ever since I was a teenager, and I'm 65 now, but I got to tell you about this community cookbook I got at the Edgar Allan Poe home in Richmond, Virginia. It's called Food to Die For. It's a book of funeral foods, tips, and tales.
Oh, wow.
It is amazing. It is from the Old City Cemetery in Lynchburg, Virginia, and it is sponsored by them, but it also, then the sales of the book go to help support this Old City Cemetery in Lynchburg. And
I love it.
It has pictures of, it's a la Adam's Family. It has pictures of gravestones and one woman who kind of organized it very in her very southern way. You know, she has tips of how to prepare your food and deliver it and what types of food. And one of my favorite tips is keep your silver polished.
Wow. Okay, Ad, thank you so much. Well, Crystal, you're in Baltimore, Edgar Allan Poe country there.
Yes, absolutely. I guess I gasped when she said Edgar Allan Poe house. I was like, what? Oh, my gosh. Food to Die For. I actually wrote that down. I'm going to look into that. That's amazing. And that is one of the things that I very much love about old cookbooks. There's a whole index oftentimes of different types of springform pans, different pickling methods, all of those things. So if you're someone who may no longer have a connection to elders in your family or maybe grew up in a family where baking food was not really a big thing and, you know, your family was more into the industrialized version of, like, canned peas and, you know, what, Jell-O's, whatever, you know, that is something that you can kind of dive into in a community cookbook, really revisiting the past and learning about how to pickle watermelon rinds or how to make your own mayonnaise, things like that. And really little fun tips and tricks that you wouldn't necessarily think about asking for. So I think that's really, really special. And I love that. I love that polish your silver. That's so great.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to Crystal Mack. She's the editor of a new digital community cookbook called How to Take Care. We've got a link to that at WPR.org/Central Time. You can find out how to get it free with proof of donation to Domestic Violence Victims Advocacy or Support Group. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Oregon. Pat, hi.
Hi. Are you there?
Yep. What did you want to tell us about, Pat?
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. I have a funny story about a Lutheran church 100-year anniversary cookbook. So about 27 or 28 years ago, we had our 100th anniversary at Cooksville Lutheran Church in Cooksville, Wisconsin, down by Evansville. And I contributed a recipe for my favorite Christmas cookie. So the bishop came to speak, and his wife came along. Well, his wife happened to be my teaching assistant at LaFollette High School, where I had my office. And so they came and we greeted them and she bought a cookbook. And the next week on Monday, I guess it would have been at school, she came up to me and she said, Pat, I expected the Lutheran Church Ladies Cookbook to be full of Jell-O salad recipes, which is, you know, the old, you know, joke about Lutheran basement ladies. So she said, the first recipe I opened to was yours. And I thought, okay, I put in my brownies, I put in some other things. She said, and the first direction for the Christmas cookies was soak 3 cups of raisins in a half a cup of bourbon.
Uh-oh.
Oh. I love it.
That was not what I expected in a church, yeah. In a Lutheran church cookbook.
I love it, Pat. I got to try these cookies myself. Well, Crystal, in our last couple minutes, I wanted to touch on another part of the How to Take Care cookbook. It isn't just, and you mentioned this, it isn't just food and beverages. There's some kind of self-care tips, recipes, advice. Can you talk about that side of things a little?
Yeah, so I wanted it to be more of like a contemporary take on a classic community cookbook. Like we mentioned, you know, there will be tips like make sure your silverware is polished, or little tricks about how to pickle and make Jell-O molds and things like that. But I was thinking to myself, what are the things that aren't necessarily food related but are self-care related, and that could be shared here? And I reached out to people that I knew were more in the wellness section, and I have a few like yoga friends and farmer friends and other healers and artists and artisans, and I reached out to them and I was like, hey guys, if you want to contribute something that isn't necessarily food related but you think would be a really lovely thing for someone to do while they're in self-isolation, please let me know. And I got a really great response. There are some skincare recipes contributed by me and contributed by some of my colleagues. And then there's also breathing exercises to kind of help heal and calm the body. There's a sleep meditation in there, something that you can listen to before you go to sleep. If you are having a hard time falling asleep, I know that right now, even personally, I can speak for myself. I've been having a really difficult time falling asleep. I think it's mostly because of the change in schedule and not being out and not moving around as much. And also just the stress and the worry that we're all experiencing right now. So I think that, you know, when I was putting this together, I was like, you know, I want this to be, it is called How to Take Care and it is a self-care book, but I really want it to be something that does more than nourish the body with food. I want it to be something that can nourish the spirit as well.
And we leave it there. Thanks to Crystal Mack. We've been talking about the new community cookbook she edited called How to Take Care. Find more about it at WPR.org Central Time and a few of the recipes we've talked about at WPR.org/Food Friday. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a researcher tells us how artificial intelligence is making the world a much weirder place. First, we're just days away from the special election that will determine who will represent Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Tuesday's election is for the seat previously held by Republican Representative Sean Duffy, who resigned last year. This race will determine who finishes the remainder of Duffy's term. Whoever wins in the special election would have to run again in November in order to retain the seat. We talked to Republican candidate State Senator Tom Tiffany on the show yesterday. Today, we're joined by Democratic candidate Tricia Zunker. She's president of the Wausau School Board and an associate justice on the Ho-Chunk Supreme Court. Tricia, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob. I'm so happy to be here today.
Well, we talked to you before the primary election. Can you remind us your basic elevator pitch, why you are the best candidate for the seat?
Well, I'm running because now more than ever, we see how critical it is that we have real representation for the people. I'm running because we need to have affordable, accessible health care, including mental health care. We need to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions stay protected, something that my opponent does not support. Look at the coronavirus global pandemic. Somebody could recover from having coronavirus and deemed to have a pre-existing condition. They shouldn't be penalized for, you know, falling victim essentially to this global pandemic. We need to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions stay protected. Also, as the granddaughter of a dairy farmer, the small and mid-sized farmer crisis that we're seeing here, this needs to be addressed. Washington Republicans have turned their backs on our small and mid-sized farmers, and we need to stand up and support our farmers. I'm also running because we need to ensure expansion of broadband access. We see that again now more than ever during this global pandemic. You know, students can't get online to do their schoolwork. People can't get the information that they need because they don't have access to rural broadband. And that is something that I would work very hard on. and I'm running to protect the environment. It is so critical to me that we ensure clean air, clean water, and that our beautiful land stay protected from corporate greed for generations to come. I know my opponent was on yesterday talking to you about this, and mining is such a big deal here in the northern part of the state, but we have to make sure that our lands stay protected. There's no such thing as safe sulfide mining, and the laws that have now been enacted here in the state of Wisconsin, specifically Act 134, favor mining companies and not the environment, and we need to make sure we have somebody in Congress who's going to stand up for the environment. So those are a few reasons, but first and foremost, quite frankly, whoever wins next Tuesday has to hit the ground running and address this coronavirus global pandemic, and I'm prepared to do that, to make sure that our families have what they need, that our farmers have what they need, that our small businesses have what they need, to make sure that they get the funding that they're supposed to and that there's oversight, to make sure that we have protective equipment in our hospitals and for all of our frontline workers. I mean, people that are keeping our economy going need to have access to paid sick leave, and they need to be valued for the critical work that they're doing. There's just so much that needs to be done. I've been a hard worker.
I want to jump in and
looking forward to working hard in for the people of Wisconsin in Congress.
Yeah, I want to get into what would happen if you were in Congress now. There's talk about a next phase, a next round of economic recovery packaging from Congress. What would be your priorities in the House if you were elected for economic recovery from COVID?
Well, we need to make sure that we have something that is sustainable and not just a Band-Aid. There are people that are still waiting on their stimulus check. There are people that are having difficulty getting their unemployment and people that are struggling. And we need to do everything that we can to alleviate struggle during this time. This is a difficult and uncertain time. And we don't know how long this is going to last. The experts are saying that, you know, we could have a second wave of this in the fall. So we need to listen to the experts. We need to do everything we can to be proactive instead of reactive, make sure that our families have the funding that they need, that our small businesses have the loans that were intended for them. And that's what when I mentioned oversight, you know, I was reading and learning about companies that were receiving these small business loans that shouldn't be getting those. And that's wrong. So we need to make sure that we have oversight. We need to make sure that there's adequate testing and that there is funding for people that are on the front lines to make sure that they have the protective equipment that they need, to make sure that our people that are keeping our grocery stores stocked and you know, working to keep the economy running, that they're valued for the work that they're doing, and again, that they have access to paid sick leave if they need it. And also our nonprofits, they need to have some support. You know, the food banks have really been relied on heavily during this time. People that typically haven't had to use them are going to the food banks, and our food banks are becoming exhausted as a result. So we need to make sure that everybody has what they need during this time and prioritize getting funding to ensure that nobody goes bankrupt throughout this time.
Yeah, we have these record unemployment numbers coming out now. Do you think that enough has been done so far to help people who have lost their jobs because of COVID-19?
Well, I'm talking to people that are having a difficult time getting their unemployment still. I've had people reach out to me, and I'm trying my best to assist them. You know, it's really difficult here. We don't have a representative right now for people to reach out to. So I'm doing my best to try and direct them to resources. But we have to make sure that we have a it's kind of simple things, right? Let's reduce confusion and chaos. Let's make the information as accessible as possible for people, and let's speed up the process. This idea that people aren't going to get the funding that they need for quite some time, well, bills continue to accrue every single day for us here in America, and we need to make sure that people have access to the funds they need right away.
Before we move on from economic recovery, how about support for state or local governments? That's been a controversy over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think that state governments absolutely need to have support from the federal government. We're in this together, and it looks different in different states. I think education is critical, making sure that people are aware of the risks of coronavirus. There's still a lot of miseducation or misunderstanding, rather, in regards to what it looks like. You know, some people don't really understand that they can be asymptomatic, they can be a carrier, they can be exposing and transmitting this disease to other people. We need to make sure that people are wearing masks out in public to protect the health and safety of others, and we need to do everything that we can to flatten the curve. And I think that we're doing that very well here in Wisconsin, but I don't think that, you know, state government should be penalized This is a difficult time, and that is the role of the federal government, I think, is in part, we have to get through this together. We can't let some states flounder while others maybe are doing better, and we need to assist them.
Talking to Tricia Zunker, Democratic candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 7th congressional seat, special election there next week. Do you see things where you could reach across the aisle and work with Republicans if you were elected?
Absolutely. There's a number of things that we should be able to work on. Number one, I think that drastically lowering the cost of prescription drugs. This is really important to me. I've spent thousands upon thousands of miles getting my car throughout this expansive district and talking to voters and hearing their concerns. And I've talked to people that have had to ration their prescription drugs because of the skyrocketing costs of them. I've talked to people that have serious concerns about the cost of insulin, which is something that people need to survive. And I am prepared to take on Big Pharma, and I know that this is something that is not just limited to one side of the aisle or another. I mean, we should not be paying these skyrocketing costs of prescription drugs. They are overcharging us here in America up to 10 times what they charge that same exact drug or medication in other countries. So this isn't a controversial position. I believe that we can work across the aisle and work to reduce the cost of prescription drugs. I think also rural broadband access. This is so critical. And this is something, whether, you know, Republican, Democrat, we have rural parts of the country, and Wisconsin 7 is the most rural part of the state. And we see how critically we need to expand rural broadband access, because without access to broadband, we are depriving people of opportunity. I know what it's like to have opportunities in my life. I've had opportunities in my life that I seized upon, and they made my life better as a result. And I believe that's the role of a representative, to present opportunity. And that is what expanding broadband access does. It provides opportunity to people. Again, something that I think we can work across the aisle and achieve that for people, to allow them opportunity.
As we wrap up, let's talk about congressional oversight of the executive branch and the president. How do you view the role of a House member in overseeing the executive branch?
Well, certainly there are separate branches of government, but there's an appropriate time to call out branches for failure to do their job. And I think that occurs, whether it's been, you know, earlier this year or last fall, rather, the role of Congress at that time. There's an appropriate time and place, and I'm certainly prepared to work with President Trump and his administration to tackle this global pandemic and get Wisconsinites through it. The bottom line is, we need somebody in Congress who's going to work hard for the people of Wisconsin. I'm prepared to do that to make life better here.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for the time. Appreciate it.
That's Tricia Zunker, a Democrat running for Wisconsin's 7th congressional seat. She's president of the Wausau School Board and an associate justice on the Ho-Chunk Supreme Court. We talked to her Republican opponent, State Senator Tom Tiffany, on the show yesterday. You can find that conversation online at WPR.org. Voters in the 7th District can cast their ballots on Tuesday, May 12th. Coming up, we'll talk to an artificial intelligence researcher about the weird, wondrous world of teaching machines how to learn. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, a free online psychology course looks at natural reactions to life during a pandemic. Two of the instructors share some practical lessons. Now, when it comes to artificial intelligence, many people are wary of the technology, maybe even afraid. In science fiction, AI is typically seen as dangerous or antagonistic, like in this scene from 2001, A Space Odyssey.
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
But outside the realm of fiction, some kinds of artificial intelligence are already here and have a very real place in our everyday lives. AI plays a role on your phone as a digital personal assistant like Siri or Alexa, or helping you avoid traffic through a phone map or finding answers through Google. But as AI technology advances, researchers are finding that teaching machines how to learn can have downright bizarre and sometimes hilarious results. Janelle Shane is an artificial intelligence researcher. She's behind the blog AI Weirdness, and her latest book is You Look Like a Thing, and I Love You, How Artificial Intelligence Works and Why It's Making the World a Weirder Place. Janelle, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, great to be talking with you.
Well, I'll admit I'm having a bit of a fan moment here because I read your site. It's hazardous to my health because I laugh so much. So I'm really glad to talk to you today. Let's start off talking about what we mean when we say artificial intelligence in the real, not science fictional world.
Yeah, and that's a tricky one because the science fiction one is often the most familiar kind that we hear about. But real life, when people who make these programs say artificial intelligence, they mean a particular kind of computer program that instead of being told exactly how to solve a problem, it has to figure out for itself how to solve the problem via trial and error.
How do you do that on a practical level? How do you give a machine the data and tell it to learn for itself?
Well, sometimes you give it examples of what you want. In the case of, recognizing images, you give it a bunch of images of a dog and say, this is a dog. And then you give it a bunch of images of a soccer ball and say, this is a soccer ball. But you end up with, because you're letting it figure out for itself what part of the image is dog and which part of the image is soccer ball, you'll get cases where the algorithms will think that a human's foot is part of the soccer ball, or maybe the grass in the background is part of the soccer ball or the dog, because it doesn't understand what it's seeing. It's just trying to copy the examples you gave it.
Let's talk about how smart these neural networks are. I think we think of, maybe a C-3PO who's fluent in every language in the galaxy, or HAL, or godlike intelligences. We're more in the ballpark of a worm here, you write.
Yeah, this is my best guess just based on looking at raw computing power. And I think that's one thing that we sometimes get confused about, since the AIs in science fiction are all, around human level or smarter, is that when we're talking about the things that are actually on our phones, filtering photos or tagging photos or giving us search results, they are very, very limited. And you have to give them a very simple job to do. And yeah, somewhere around the level of an earthworm is more or less what to think of when thinking of these.
Now, on the serious side of the way we use artificial intelligence, I think sometimes we think of this as this great, neutral way, non-biased way to evaluate a job candidate or something like that. But you write, a lot of our own biases end up finding their way into these neural networks and the way they act. Can you tell us how that works?
Yeah, so like I said, these kinds of algorithms, they learn by example. They learn by copying what they see humans do. And because they don't understand the implications of what they're deciding, or, where this fits into society, or even what these numbers really mean, they will copy everything that they see humans do. And as we know, a lot of human decisions, to take one example, job hunting, sorting resumes, people are measurably biased when it comes to that. You change the name on a resume and that can totally affect whether a certain person gets an interview or not. And so what people would find, Amazon published an example of this recently, where they had been working on a hiring algorithm that they didn't end up using because they noticed that it kept trying to discriminate against female applicants. And it would be really sneaky about this, too. It wasn't explicitly told that women were to be discriminated against, they weren't even told which resumes belonged to women, but they were able to figure all this out just through clues like, oh, did this resume go to a women's college, or were they on a softball team or a women's soccer team? So these algorithms used all these sneaky clues that we didn't even know that we were giving it in order to copy everything that it saw the humans do, including these sort of biased behaviors that Amazon didn't want them to copy. So Amazon never ended up rolling out this particular program, but there are a lot of programs that people use in hiring now that have the potential to be very biased, and probably are, unless they've shown evidence that they're not.
We're talking about the real world of artificial intelligence with Janelle Shane. Her new book is called You Look Like a Thing and I Love You, How Artificial Intelligence Works and Why It's Making the World a Weirder Place. Let's check out the title there, You Look Like a Thing and I Love You. Tell us where that came from.
Well, that came from an experiment where I was trying to train one of these algorithms to generate pickup lines. And so this was another one of these things where I gave it examples of existing pickup lines and tell it, okay, try to figure out via trial and error how to write more lines that are like these. And unfortunately, the AI I gave this task to was definitely not up to the challenge. And one of the lines it came up with was, you look like a thing and I love you.
You got to have researchers try these in bars sometime. Now, you've branched out to a lot of the ones I've been reading over the years are text. There have been images, including some really scary cat creatures, but music, too. And you wrote about artificial intelligence trying to learn how to make music by teaching it styles and inputting a song. So I want to give a listen to one of these. Okay, that's an artificial intelligence version of Baby Shark in the style of Ella Fitzgerald. I just hit the ballpark, actually. What do we learn when we try to teach machines to make music like this?
Well, you know, we get some pretty fun results out. I mean, this is, you know, impressive work by a team at OpenAI to actually get lyrics and get a bunch of other things, audience noises and things into these sound files, AI generated sound files that we really weren't able to before. But, you know, it's kind of fun. You know, it doesn't always hit the mark, especially if you give it really weird lyrics to try and do. But even if you give it kind of ordinary lyrics and tell it write a new song, it's definitely not as good as a human composer. So one of the experiments they did is they gave this algorithm the lyrics to Yesterday and told it to sing the song in the style of the Beatles. And, you know, it sings a song, but it's not nearly as interesting and full of character as the original Yesterday.
Now, you've posted on your website, AI Weirdness, your blog, all these lists of names of candles or recipes or my favorite. I think the one that got me hooked was paint colors. What have been some of the most hilarious things from your perspective that your neural networks have come up with?
Oh, well, you know, I'm particularly fond of the projects that where people get involved. So there was one project that I called Skynet, where I was generating knitting patterns. And then a group of knitters actually turned these into real knitted objects. And, you know, they were very strange looking. They had all these sort of weird holes and branching patterns. They looked like nothing that a human knitter would have ever come up with. And I just love that, where, you know, you get the human creativity playing with what the AI has come up with and making something new.
Now, what's on the frontier for you and the projects you're working on? What's in the hopper?
Well, I have been having fun playing more with other media, like, you know, generating images and looking at music. These are sort of new for me. And what has helped make that possible is there's a lot more tools out there than there used to be. You used to have to do programming and install a bunch of stuff, and it was a big pain to do experiments like this. But now they've got these, you know, web interfaces, they've got these desktop programs where you don't have to code, you can just point and click. And it makes it a lot easier and faster to do experiments with this.
And Janelle, briefly, I know somebody reached out to ask you for a name for a burlesque show generated by neural networks. Do you get a lot of requests from people, and I guess be careful what they wish for, to come up with names for things?
I do, yeah. And, you know, that's a lot of fun, too. I helped a brewery in Michigan, Old Nation Brewery, come up with a beer that it ended up being called the Fine Stranger.
Well, that's not bad. I drink the Fine Stranger beer. Janelle, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's Janelle Shane, artificial intelligence researcher. You can find a lot of artificial intelligence wackiness on her blog, AI Weirdness. She joined us to talk about her latest book. It's called You look like a thing, and I love you. How artificial intelligence works and why it's making the world a weirder place. She talks about different artificial intelligence from the real world and from fiction, how they match up and how artificial intelligence and neural networks sometimes show up in surprising places in our lives. All right, here's some bonus material from Janelle Shane and her neural network friends. Just in time for Mother's Day, here are some scented candle names generated by neural networks. Buy your mom these delightful candle scents. Ready? Okay, we'll see how many I can get through. Frozen styrofoam, asparagus and pumpkin candle, marshmallow chutney, turnips, lemon lime decay, volcanoes comfort, friendly wetsuit. Okay, and that's from the initial list that she'd post on her blog. Here's from the bonus material, because I subscribe. The following scented candles: Ferris Bueller's Time Spy, randomly scaled glass, steamed water, new car harvest, and deck the flies. Other options: bunny parmesan, jelly toes, rude celebration, the holiday spaghetti candle, cobra and sea salt, deep fried green bean, steamed snow is falling, wildflower tombs, Gotham Knights, and lots of bunny ones. Mountain bunnies, berry bunnies, bunny bouquet, and bunny galaxy. All the scents that fit. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.